Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
And I just couldn't get this deal over the line. And I got the shits. Like, I just got frustrated. Like, I'm done. This is it. And I booked a trip to Thailand and I blew half of my deposit. Now, and it was just a bit of patience. I could have kept saving. It would have taken me 6 months to get that extra amount of money and get the next property. But I just got so frustrated that I threw my hands up and I walked back.
This is Property Investory, where we talk to successful property investors to find out more about their stories, mindset, and strategies. I'm Torrin Shum, and in this episode, we're back with Jackson Milan, founder of Aurelius Financial and author of 3 novels. Utilizing his 15 years of experience, Milan shares vital advice with listeners, financial knowledge, the value of mentorship, and common mistakes to avoid. And he humbly shares that failure is a normal part of success. Cultivating his 15 years of business entrepreneurship experience, Milan imparts his wisdom to listeners. Narrating the lessons he acquired from his first company, Milan reveals his formula to success, his 4 core parts of business.
Because these things get neglected, right? And it's because they're doing them manually. And because they don't have the time, they are time poor. We need to implement systems and frameworks and automations that basically set their money on autopilot. So our whole value proposition is about helping our clients manage their money in about 30 minutes a month. So who can't find 30 minutes a month?
That's the time you spend to have a coffee and, you know, maybe play your kids for whatever time. That's a great philosophy. So you've taken the business quite substantially and very, very successfully. So that turning point where you said, all right, I'm going to sell the franchise and then move on to, I'd like to sort of just touch on that just to understand the emotional feeling that do you still have a memory of how, because the thing is, you could have done something else. If you had sold your business, there could have been so many other things. Why jump back in and start another business?
Yeah, it's really interesting, mate. Although I have ADHD, and one of the symptoms of ADHD is like of chasing shiny objects, right? People with ADHD struggle to defer gratification because we chase the dopamine, right? We chase the things that are exciting and give us the thrill. However, once I set my mind on a track, I very rarely deviate from it. So other businesses weren't even an option. I realized that I had a successful formula. I'm passionate about my purpose. I want to change the world in regards to how wealth education is provided to business owners, because I realized that it's an endemic, it's an issue, it's a substantial issue, because there's just not enough work in this space. So I realized that I'd come to the capacity of that pathway. I just needed to create the next best pathway that would get me to where I want to go. So the other options weren't even on the table. But we realized we wanted to build a more holistic philosophy of having all of these businesses working together. And really my vision is to create a horizontally aligned professional and business services group. So if a business owner has anything they need around building their profit, buying back their time, and building wealth, we want to have business services that can support them with that. So a big thing I do now is acquisitions of other businesses, which has been a big wealth building strategy for us as well.
Definitely. Can you sort of elaborate a little bit on that in terms of how that works, the plan for the customers or clients?
Yes, for sure. So my whole philosophy, if we chunk it up a little bit, is there's basically 3 ways to build wealth in this world. There's business, so you need to build a valuable and saleable business. And if you have the appetite for it, acquire other businesses, which allows you to magnify your wealth substantially. Second is property. As we know, property is an amazing asset class, particularly here in Australia. And with leverage, we can maximize our cash-on-cash returns in order to take a relatively small amount of money, put that into a great asset that even if it has modest compounding, could substantially grow our wealth. And the third part is shares. Property and business is illiquid. So we need to acknowledge that we can't sell a portion of it quickly if we need to raise capital, and shares allows us to own fractions of other companies that provides us with liquidity and the ability to drip feed money into the market over time. So those are really the three main asset classes. So we teach our clients the same. For our clients who get their business to a point where it's under management, we also teach them how to go and acquire their competitors and use that as a way to magnify their wealth over time. And it's basically using value-based process and understanding opportunity cost evaluation in order to allow them to accelerate their wealth a whole lot faster.
Failure is merely success in progress. Though it would be easy just to brag about the most successful properties he's worked with, Milan humbly shares some of the failures he had to learn from. After all, the road to success is a bumpy one.
I actually want to tell the story of the first property that I missed, okay? And I think this is a really important thing, because the reason why this is important, Tyrone, is that people who are successful tend to talk a lot about their achievements. And for people who feel like they're behind on their journey, I feel that that often creates more invisible ceilings that hold them back. So I like to be very vulnerable and talk about my mistakes very openly and honestly. Now, I was 19 years old and I wanted to buy a property. And it wasn't really about the property itself. It was more about proving myself to my family that I was an adult, because I was basically the youngest out of all of our cousins and everything. And I'm like, I want to be the youngest in my family to buy a property. So I was looking at a property and my budget was about $200,000, right? And I'd save up some money. I had about $30,000 and I was looking around the southwest of Sydney and I was trying to buy this property. I didn't know what a mortgage broker was at the time. I'd banked with CBA. My parents banked with CBA. So we got a mobile banker to come out, try to look at different options and whatnot to get that done. And I was about $10,000 short on the pre-approval. So I ended up only being able to get a maximum purchase price of about $190,000 and I just couldn't get this deal over the line. And I got the shits. Like, I just got frustrated. Like, I'm done. This is it. And I booked a trip to Thailand and I blew half of my deposit. Now, and it was just a bit of patience. I could have kept saving. It would have taken me 6 months to get that extra amount of money and get the next property. But I just got so frustrated that I threw my hands up and I walked back. So that $200,000 property today is worth $750,000, right? I kick myself all of the time. I had another situation, and look, I bought a property southwest Sydney, did quite well with it, had some equity, and then I went to go buy my second property. Very similar story. Property was in Dulwich Hill, went to the auction, got turned in. I was prepared to pay $750,000 for this property or thereabouts, and the guy, the vendor selling, wanted $760,000. Funnily enough, the same $10,000 gap, right? And I go, nope. It's not worth it. I've got the valuation. It's $750,000. I'm not going to pay it. That property's worth $1.5 million today. And it just, it's this hindsight, right? We sweat the small stuff. And like I heard this analogy many years later and I go, I wish my younger self knew this. Our parents talk about buying their property in the 80s for like $30,000, right? Like, my mortgage was 20%. I paid $30,000. When have they ever said, I wish I negotiated it to $25,000 instead of $30,000. Never. You never hear that, right? So I've made a lot of mistakes around property. It's cost me millions. And I've been fortunate enough to accumulate a number of properties now. My philosophy is if I can accumulate one good quality property a year for the next 5 to 10 years, borrowing capacity pending, then I'm going to be fine. And my strategy is very, very simple, Tyrone. I focus on fundamental principles based on net migration, based on diversified employment, of infrastructure spending, of capped future supply, and understanding affordability in the market. And if I can understand those five fundamental principles, buying in good quality blue chip areas and set and forget for the long term, then the market does everything else for me.
Exactly. And that's what I love about that. That's, you know, that key fundamental principles that you said there is spot on to what most successful investors have been doing. It's not about, you know, as you said, negotiating that thing, because it's like $5,000-$10,000. In the hindsight of things, it's small, and you know, it's nothing. But the thing is ultimately getting into the market is the challenge, because everyone says that's so hard to get your first one. And once you get your first one, the next one in the future is so much easier. I love that story lesson because I resonate with that, and that's what I did as well. I think we all do it, but we just don't talk about it. So I'm glad that you shared it. Thank you for sharing that.
Well, I like to remove these taboos. And look, if anybody can leave with this, taking that lesson away from our costly mistakes, then I think that helps. And look, I think the last thing that I'll share on that, mate, is that my next biggest mistake in terms of property was buying an off-the-plan property. And it was one of these things that the property itself wasn't bad, but it was just the analogy of buying a new car and driving it off the lot. And like when we understand that in my situation, bought this nice property, but paid the new car price for it. And we understand that property is normally driven by the appreciation of the land value and the asset value is depreciating. And I was caught up and sold on this whole depreciation benefit, obviously earning high income and getting the deductions on it. But what I didn't realize is that through the depreciation, there is actually a reduction in the cost base, meaning that although I'm getting a cash back on the cash flow as a result of the depreciation, it lowers my cost base, meaning that it's increasing my capital gains tax when I sell. And that was the next big lesson that I learned. So my principles are: buy properties based on their fundamentals and never buy an asset based on the tax benefits. Tax is a consequence of making money. And although it may be nice as an added benefit, if you buy a good quality property that gives you some tax benefits, great, but it must be a good quality property first. And that was an expensive lesson for me as well.
Well, it's a very important lesson because, and I've heard it for many, many years, many people in the past, and this is when they had negative gearing, was actually buying property for the sake of negative gearing. To me, it didn't make sense. It's like, you know, you're paying $2 to government and they're giving you a dollar back. Like, you may as well give that to me. I'll keep the dollar, thank you. But people were doing that left, right, and center. And then they got themselves in a position where in the future, they just had so much debt and so many properties, but they couldn't service it because it was so negatively cash flowed that it really, really hurt them. I still see it happen, but I don't hear it as often as we do now because I think with all the wealth knowledge and coaching and stuff that's been going around, people have actually changed their perspective. And you're right, it's stick with the fundamentals, and as long as your property is in good locations, meets those criteria, it's blue chip. You know, you just hold it for it's a wealth creation tool.
Exactly. And look, I think that's obviously more challenging now with interest rates the way that they are, because there are a lot of people that are in pain and trying to get a positively geared property in this market is pretty challenging. But I think the important part is understand the accrual of your cash losses and ensure that based on the property that you're looking to acquire, the capital growth assumptions are going to outweigh the cash that you're losing along the way. Because I think one of the big parts here is we need to afford to be able to hold on to this property until we get that appreciation. And we need to ensure that at the end of the day, if we do realize that and we get the capital gain, has that compensated us for the cash losses along the way? And if not, what's the point?
Of course, we've all heard it a million times, buy property. For those of us listening who don't really know why, Milan explains perfectly.
I think the big part is that wealth creation and financial freedom for me is very simple. There's two things we're trying to achieve. I believe you should own your home and have it paid off in full. And the idea behind that is that if you own your home and it's fully paid off, not only does it give you confidence and peace of mind, but it's going to free up at least 30 to 40% of your household cash flow, which either can be repurposed towards more discretionary spending and more lifestyle stuff, or drastically reduce how much you need in terms of financial freedom. And the second goal is that you need to build enough wealth that produces passive income that allows you to have freedom how you choose to spend your time. So for me personally, we're in our dream home. We've still got a mortgage, but on track to pay that off over the next few years. And my passive income goal is $200,000 a year, which basically means that I need to accumulate about $4 to $5 million in investment assets. And if I achieve that, then I'll be able to produce that 200 grand a year in perpetuity. Now, the big thing for me is that property is an ancillary part of my overall strategy because of the returns that I achieve in business, particularly through acquisitions. So typically speaking, in my business acquisitions, we produce anywhere between a 30 to 100% year-on-year return. And that's mainly because of the way that we use leverage and the way that we structure those deals. And also because I can be actively involved in that, I have more control over it than a property. So my focus is business acquisitions first, and that's where I've built the majority of my wealth. And then the second component is that where there is extra free cash flow, that I utilize that to buy good quality blue chip property that I set and forget. And then thirdly, any remaining surplus goes into a diversified index fund. And essentially that allows me to build the three components of my strategy. I've got my active wealth, I've got my property strategy, and then I've got my liquid diversified strategy.
Strategy. Yeah, that's wonderful. So you mentioned that you're one of the key things that you've been doing successfully is acquiring businesses. So what type of businesses are we sort of referring to, just on a general basis?
So all of the businesses that I acquire are what I refer to as strategic acquisitions, and they all align with businesses that offer services to our ideal client avatar, being business owners. And so primarily they are financial advisory businesses, accounting businesses, mortgage broking businesses, outsourcing businesses. Those have been our main focus in terms of acquisitions, because that ultimately is our core suite of services. And most of our acquisitions have been basically tuck-in acquisitions, smaller acquisitions that we can roll into our group and deliver substantial service above and beyond what those clients we used to, and then be able to cross-sell the other services that we offer once we've been able to show that we can deliver a lot of value.
Oh, that's very smart. So basically, that's been one of the quickest way, from what I can hear, to accelerate your business is basically you're able to, I guess, acquire another business to be able to get the clientele, and then from the clientele be able to cross-sell all the other services that you have in your business. So that really rolls into a very, very smart strategy. How long has that? You said 6 years when you first started. So how long ago did you start acquiring businesses?
Yeah, so we actually, our whole value proposition, because we realized that selling out of the previous business, we're going back to dollar zero, right? And we wanted to build up steam quickly. So acquisitions was actually a part of our original business strategy. So we actually did our first acquisition, I think, within the first 3 months of launching Aureus. And our aim has been to try and do at least a couple of acquisitions a year. Last year was a big year of acquisitions for us. I think we closed five. It's been some pretty good growth.
Yeah, absolutely. And how do you find these? Because I've got a lot of curiosity inside this realm of acquiring businesses, but I personally haven't done it myself. I've always built a business and then sold it off, but never bought one. So just if you could just touch on that, it'd be really interesting to share with the audience and listeners to hear about that.
The best deals are not businesses that are listed on the public market. And the reason for it is because businesses that are on the public market are largely going to sell for a premium, because those people are typically ready and primed for sale. And like any transaction, it's all about supply and demand. So when it's on the public market, there's typically multiple people bidding for it. So a lot of our best deals have come from our network, and individuals who have wanted to get out, or have had a change in circumstance, or have believed in our vision and had wanted to join on board with us by way of a roll-up strategy. And there's multiple ways to structure deals. Most of them have come through networking. So what's really important around this is understanding, from an acquisition standpoint, how do you develop a philosophy? What are you actually trying to achieve in business? Then work out what are the types of businesses that meet that criteria, that philosophy. Then start building a list of individuals, much like you would with a client list or a prospect list. And then how do you approach those individuals, facilitate the conversations, and then start working out how you structure a deal, and then doing your due diligence. It is a very time-consuming process. It's can be frustrating as well, because there are a lot of deals. You end up saying no to more deals than you say yes to. As we probably know, the small business space, particularly for kind of owner-operators, they can be cowboys sometimes, right? So there's businesses that you may not necessarily want to acquire. So being able to have a really robust methodology around due diligence and deal making is really important. But it's definitely a skill, and you've got to have time to devote to doing it properly.
Definitely. And the other thing I probably would say is a lot of these are usually individual sole operators. You know, they've been in the business for a while and they've got a lot of emotion behind it. So they think that the business is worth a lot more than what it's actually worth. So that's another challenge you'd have to deal with. And it's actually very similar to property when you think about it. Well, it probably is the same when you're actually going, say, look for a development site and you want to find, you know, you got to go and find them. It's not like they're always listed on the market. You got to go and door knock and so forth. And a lot of times the people have been living there for a long time. They don't want to sell, but there's an opportunity there for a development site, and you got to, you know, get that over the line to look at the numbers and make it worthwhile for everyone. Win-win. So very similar.
It's all about that feasibility, right? And once you get that philosophy right, when you can sell people on the vision, you can show them what's in it for them, then it's actually not that difficult. But deals fall over sometimes at the last minute, which can be very frustrating. I'm sure you've seen the same in terms of the development site situation. But it's part of the business. It's all part of the journey.
Coming up after the break, Milan explains the most vital educational tool one must possess.
In fact, it's probably more important to understand the game of finance, because in all of those deals that I explained that fell over were all due to lack of understanding about finance. And what I mean by that is how lending structures work, how servicing works, how equity works, how bank assessment policy works, all of these things. I just didn't understand.
He reflects on the importance of mentors.
And that's been the most integral part. And following my curiosity to find people who've done the things that I want to do and then pick their brain and get access to their knowledge and then go and implement it and basically make them proud.
He warns listeners of the common mistakes that block individual success.
And for most people, they have low motivation to manage their cash flow and high perceived difficulty, which means that they inevitably fail. They do not pass the action threshold, meaning they don't do the right action.
And that's next. I'm Tarun Sharm, and you're listening to Property Investory. For Milan, the learning curve was large. Sharing some of his struggles, Milan encourages listeners to have the right tools before pursuing their own property journey. And he starts giving them to us right now.
The big part was I was laser focused on the property piece and I wasn't interested in the finance piece, right? And you need to understand the game of finance before you understand the game of property. In fact, it's probably more important to understand the game of finance, because in all of those deals that I explained that fell over were all due to lack of understanding about finance. And what I mean by that is how lending structures work, how servicing works, how equity works, how bank assessment policy works, all of these things. I just didn't understand. My first interaction with property was going directly with a bank. I didn't even realize that a mortgage broker was a thing. Like, I'm certain a mortgage broker could have found me another lender that had more flexible lending policy that could have got me the extra money. Then in that second scenario with the Dulwich Hill property, I took the word of the broker and I didn't challenge him. I didn't say, hey, what can you do to find me other deals? Could we go to a specialist lender and then refinance later on down the track? I didn't speak the lingo. I just took his word. So because I didn't take a vested interest in understanding the game of finance and looking to learn, that's where I lost the money. And that was 100% my fault. So fortunately enough, as owning a mortgage broking business, I've been intimately involved in this and I've understood it. But more importantly, we've built a philosophy to teach our clients the language of finance and help them play an active role in learning how do they influence their borrowing capacity. For example, how does servicing work and what can you do to influence servicing? How do you structure entities, particularly your business, or how do you use special purpose vehicles in order to maximize your long-term borrowing capacity? How do you structure equity? Do you cross-collateralize? Do you cash out and have everything independent? Family guarantees, other types of deal structures. Learning this kind of thing and equipping our clients with that toolkit makes for a better client, because they're coming to us and seeking value, and then we can talk the same language as opposed to them getting upset when they don't get the particular outcome. It's okay, we either get the outcome or this is what you need to go and do over this financial year, so then we can go and get that outcome next year, right? And it allows us to have a proactive strategy irrespective.
Yeah, I love it. It's so important to really educate yourself. I mean, from what we're having this conversation, I think the key thing is a lack of knowledge, because that's where it brings up fear and loss and so forth like that. But actually, when you educate yourself and you learn all the principles and understand how it all works, it actually makes sense. And it's like, I guess, riding a bike. If you've never ridden a bike, you're going to be scared because you're thinking you're going to fall, you're going to crash, you're going to all that. But as soon as you learn to ride and balance, it's like, oh, this is the best thing in life. Get around. So it's really, really amazing. Education is just so important, and it's also feeding the mind with the right things as well, which is actually the perfect segue into talking about mindset stuff, because that's the reason why I wanted to talk about it as well. So I guess looking at all the mentors and resources, because you said you've had some numerous mentors, tell us a little bit more about some of them that have been able to influence you, and maybe share what you've learned from them as well.
Yeah, I've always had a big belief in having mentors, mainly for accountability, right? I found throughout my life, I've always wanted to find people that inspired me and then rise to their level. And that's been the most integral part. And following my curiosity to find people who've done the things that I want to do and then pick their brain and get access to their knowledge and then go and implement it and basically make them proud. That's always been my whole philosophy. And it's always been on this idea of rising tides lifting all ships. Now, the big thing for me in terms of mindset is that early in my career, I was chasing tactics. Like most people I touched on earlier, people are asking the wrong questions, and I was asking the wrong questions too. And I thought that wealth was created by building sexy portfolios and outsmarting the market and getting all of the timing right. I'd probably watch too many Wall Street movies.
I think we all do it.
Yeah, and there was a moment for me which kind of come to a head where I was working with this particular group of clients, high income earners, living hand to mouth, right? Living on credit cards, just not getting ahead, very much keeping up with the Joneses and succumbing to that cash flow creep as their income had increased. And I designed this amazing strategy for them. Very complicated with lots of moving parts, but it guaranteed they were going to get to their goals. Like, if you follow this plan, you do all of these actions, you implement this, you will achieve all of your goals. And 3 months in, they'd stuffed it up. And I almost wanted to grab them by the shoulders and shake them, like, what's wrong with you? And it was that moment, their mindset wasn't ready. They were not capable of following the strategy because they hadn't expanded that invisible ceiling yet. And then I started going really deep into behavioral finance. And one of the most fundamental lessons that I learned was loss aversion bias. It is the understanding that as human beings, we feel the emotion of loss twice as significantly as the emotion of gain. And it makes sense when you understand it. Like, we go back to caveman times, we didn't have any certainty of a roof over our head or whether we were going to have food or whether we were going to be eaten by a saber-toothed tiger, right? So when we had resource, we guarded it with our lives. And we still experience this today in the modern day, right? That unless you've got a significant purpose of why you are foregoing your peace of mind, you will never move past that invisible ceiling. And what I basically said is, well, if I feel the emotion of loss twice as much as the emotion of gain, I must put twice as much energy and effort into pursuing the gain and the purpose behind pursuing the gain. Because if I don't, I'm going to stay where I am. And this is a lot of our philosophy. How do we increase the purpose and the perspective of the future, but raise the floor in terms of the systems that we fall back on? And this allows us to constantly create what I call money muscle memory. We are reinforcing positive repetitions that allow us to progress our position.
Helping change our mindsets, Milan shares the 4 key ingredients needed to be successful.
The first thing we did is we had brutal transparency. So I forced them to come face to face with their shortcomings and name them. And okay, we stuffed up because we blew out the credit card and we chose not to take action on the plan because of XYZ. Cool. This is what we call the feedback loop. We had a perspective. Imagine that as a circle. We had the reality of another circle and they weren't overlapped basically at all, right? And what we're trying to do is through reflection, we're trying to get these circles overlapped, calibrated. Second thing, we spent more time defining what it is that they wanted and why they wanted it. And this was like, okay, well, I want to buy a house in Manly. I want to be able to travel with my family every year. I want to be able to retire at 60. I want to be able to have my home paid off in 10 years. All of these things. And then we determine significance around these things. Like, why is this important? Like, why do you really want that? Then third thing, we implemented cash flow structure. And what we did is we segmented all of their cash flow, fixed expenses from discretionary weekly, lumpy bills and holidays, and then surplus. And what that did is that it used Parkinson's law to limit the means they had available, therefore limiting the means that they had available to use. And then the fourth thing is that we allocated surplus in advance. We set up, as soon as they got paid, allocating the surplus out of sight, out of mind, once again using Parkinson's law because they didn't have the money to spend. And we removed the credit card because the credit card is the worst financial mechanism ever created for wealth building. The worst. I've actually done an empirical study on this that I've proven that for most, the vast majority of people, even those who pay off their credit card monthly and never pay interest, their credit card costs them in excess of $300,000 over a decade to hold. And the reason is they spend more than they would if it was their own money.
That's right. That's the problem. Well, that's what how credit cards make money, or credit card companies make money.
Exactly. That they aren't in the business of giving away things for free.
No way. You know, they think that, yeah, you get this nice shiny credit card, interest free, blah, blah, blah. No, they're actually hook, line, sink, and caught you. So that is really, really amazing. I love that story. I think that's really, for me, it's been impactful just to hear that, because it's so slight changes. And I think the biggest thing is that accountability and transparency, because a lot of people usually just bury their head in the sand when they hear, oh man, this is just too hard, and I'm spending too much, I don't know what to do. They'll just put their head in the sand. And it's like, no, it's okay to actually confront it, because that's how change and growth happens. Without that, you won't make any change, and that's why you're stuck in that situation.
Exactly. And the hard part is, right, that we are ambitious, that we tend to rely too much on discipline and ethic when we haven't done the reps to do that yet. And there's actually a book called Tiny Habits written by a guy called BJ Fogg. And he created a model called the Fogg Behavioral Model, which is basically an axis of consideration around perceived difficulty and motivation to do a task. And for most people, they have low motivation to manage their cash flow and high perceived difficulty, which means that they inevitably fail. They do not pass the action threshold, meaning they don't do the right action. So through implementing these things, implementing these systems, we presuppose that we get over the action threshold more often than not, which means that we start creating positive habits and behaviors, which means that we can rely more on discipline over time, because we've got a process that is manufacturing discipline as a byproduct of following the system, as opposed to an exception to the rule.
Absolutely. And I love it. That it also, too, in many ways, like I implement a lot of what you've just said as well already as a habit, because it saves me having to think. I don't want to have to think at the end of the month, how much do I need to actually put aside for this fixed cost and all that stuff. I just want it to be all done. And it's all there. And if it's out of mind, it's out of sight, it's out of mind. So I don't have to worry about it. And that makes life so much easier. Then you can actually have your mind free to do the things that you enjoy rather than worry about cash flow stuff that goes on day to day. That's wonderful. So let's take a step back, and I think you've kind of touched on this, but let's talk on it anyway. But if you took yourself 10 years ago and you met yourself and you said, Jackson, you know, I'm here just to give you some advice, what do you think you would say to him?
I think it's about being confident and backing yourself. I struggled with a lot of self-limiting beliefs when I was younger, of feeling like I wasn't worthy and that I wasn't good enough and I didn't have what it took. And I wish I had developed that amount of self-confidence earlier. I think I'd be much further along. But frankly, I wouldn't be where I am right now if it wasn't for everything that I'd learned along the way. So I think I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be.
Wonderful. Yeah, I love that. And then let's talk about the future. Exciting things that are happening. So what are you most excited about for the future now that you've achieved your dream home? You've got your goals achieved, 90% most of it, your business is growing and so forth. But what are you most excited about now?
Yes. So my whole philosophy now is about defining the difference between enough and extra. And once you have enough, choosing to pursue extra for fun. And that's where I am. So my big focus is thought leadership. My aim is to publish 3 books a year. Every year for the rest of my life. I want to write 100 books before I die. So I've already got my next 2 books mapped out. I'm working on my 3rd one that's going to be released. I had my last book come out in December, which was great. So I've published 3 books now, 3 more this year. And I'm basically focusing on trying to grow and scale the business to 100 million, which has been going to put us in a position where we can look at a stock market listing. And the main reason for that is, one, I think it'd be awesome to be a publicly listed CEO and just understand what it's like and what it takes to be a publicly listed CEO and continue to grow and scale the business from there. and try and create as much impact as we possibly can in the world. So that's what I'm most excited about.
That's amazing. It's so cool. Well, I'd definitely be looking forward to being there on the day you list on the stock exchange. Make sure I'm there to try and hammer the bell for you. Wonderful. Well, you've achieved so much, Jackson, in a very short space of time. I guess how much of your success do you think has been due to your skill, intelligence, and hard work? And how much of it do you think has been luck?
It's interesting, mate. I wrote a post about this the other day where I said, I'm not smart.
Thank you to Jackson Milan, our guest on this episode of Property Investory.